Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the time for on-bank consideration of the case of Membrano v. Gonzalez. The court has considered the briefs, and you have been each given 30 minutes per side total, which is as much time as we give the most complex cases involving the most intricate issues of federal jurisdiction, which this does not contain. So with that in mind, we advise that you don't need to feel compelled to use all of your time. And we understand you're both ready to present arguments, so the petitioner may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Mrs. Membrano was a 47-year-old immigrant, legal permanent, long-time legal permanent resident. She was ordered removed in 1993 for a conviction of assault with a deadly weapon. The immigration court at that time considered her offense was a crime involving moral turpitude. However, the immigration court did not allow Mrs. Membrano to submit evidence as to whether or not categorically this was a crime involving moral turpitude. Moreover, the immigration court failed to allow Mrs. Membrano to apply for the petty offense exception. Her conviction at the state level was, in California, is considered a wobbler. It could have been punished either as a felony or a misdemeanor. The California court elected to punish it as a misdemeanor. Mrs. Membrano was given 180 days punishment in county jail, as well as 3 years of summer probation.
Was a judgment entered?
The judgment wasn't entered. The sentence was suspended, and she was found adjudicated guilty, pled guilty to the offense. There was 180 days punishment and 3 years probation.
I was going to say, was an imposition of sentence suspended?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's different than actually sentencing.
Yes.
The defendant.
I was key to point that the criminal court punished Mrs. Membrano, and I use that language specifically. They punished Membrano by imposing 3 years of probation, and as a condition of the probation, they gave 180 days in county jail. That is important because under 17A, it defines what crimes are felonies, misdemeanors, or infractions. And because once the imposition of punishment was elected, once the criminal court elected to punish her by 3 years probation and 180 days, it became by definition a misdemeanor offense. And because it's a misdemeanor offense, Mrs. Membrano should have been allowed to apply for the petty offense exception.
Counsel, do we use the judgment in a case of suspended imposition, or do we use this phrase in the statute, or of which the acts the alien admits having committed constitute the essential elements?
I believe we refer to the statute.
We do use what the actual conduct was and how it would fit the statute that defines the crime.
Well, if we're referring to whether or not this crime constituted a crime involving moral turpitude, looking at assault with a deadly weapon, the intent element is required is that intent only necessarily for battery. And the intent being only necessary for battery, it only requires an unlawful touching. And whether or not that constitutes a crime involving moral turpitude, it falls short of that, because a crime involving moral turpitude normally requires an element of fraud or some malicious intent, whereupon the intent required for a battery is just the unlawful touching. So there are circumstances where someone can be convicted of a crime of assault with a deadly weapon and that not be a crime involving moral turpitude.
What I'm getting at is a little different. It's whether she could qualify for the petty offense exception in any event.
I believe 517, the entire statutory scheme of 17, including 17A, 17B, 17B1 and 3, that hate crime is essentially a misdemeanor. And
but only after the judge decides to drop it to a wobbler, decides to drop the wobbler to a misdemeanor. In terms of the conduct, basically her husband and another guy are having a fist fight, and she pulls out a gun and starts shooting at people, or at one guy.
Yes.
That conduct would constitute the elements of a crime for which the maximum penalty was more than a year, or was a year or more.
In this instance, with California Penal Code 245A2, this is a crime that was punishable either as a felony or a misdemeanor. The judge in this instance elected to punish it as a misdemeanor. So this was essentially a wobbler offense, whereupon in the discretion of the criminal court, upon having the opportunity to view the record in front of it, elected to punish this offense as a misdemeanor offense.
Is it necessary for the judge at a later date, say when the summary probationary period is concluded, to then, on the record, state or file a document that states that this offense is a misdemeanor? Or is it automatically a misdemeanor based on the sentence imposed at the time the sentence was first imposed?
An offense which can be punished as a felony or misdemeanor can become a misdemeanor under several circumstances. One is if the punishment that's imposed, if probation is given, suspended sentence, and then a punishment imposed other than state imprisonment, if there's a violation of the probation, it becomes a misdemeanor for all purposes. Another method in which the offense can become a misdemeanor is if after the punishment is imposed, after probation is imposed, that the defendant go back into criminal court upon a 17B motion and move to have the courts declare it a misdemeanor. But that is not necessarily so. Under 17B1, what is required is that a punishment other than imprisonment in a state prison is a misdemeanor. Under 17B3, there are two options under 17B3. Under 17B3, it states that if the defendant moves the court to declare this matter a misdemeanor, the court can so do so in its discretion. Alternatively, 17B3 states that whereupon there's a suspended sentence, probation imposed, and there's no punishment in state prison, it becomes a misdemeanor. So 17B3, there's an or between the language. The first part of the language states that under these circumstances similar to those circumstances in which Membrano was under, that would be a misdemeanor. Following the or in the statutory language is upon a motion or upon a declaration of the criminal court to declare it a misdemeanor. So there are several ways in which a wobbler offense that's punishable either or, can become a misdemeanor.
Counsel, you said that this was punished as a misdemeanor. I'm reading from the sentence. And it says, for count one, the defendant was placed on capital felony probation. Probation. Why do you say that's a misdemeanor sentence?
Your Honor, under Garcia Lopez, where a matter is, once the accusation is made, the complaint is made, and the matter on the docket, it says a felony, that is not dispositive as to whether or not it is actually a felony or misdemeanor. What happens is that we look to the actual punishment imposed, and if there's been a violation of any probation, wherein that the punishment is the punishment that meets the definition of 17A. 17A clearly states that punishment up in county jail less than 2 years of misdemeanor, punishment in state prison, or a death penalty is a felony.
But if she violated probation, the judge could have given her 2, 3, or 4.
That is so, Your Honor. However, That's exactly correct.
Which he hadn't done. He hadn't sentenced her yet.
Your Honor, I believe the critical language is punishment as opposed to sentencing. There is, in case Fier v. Ashcroft, which is analogous to ours, that defendant was given suspended sentence, was provided probation as well as 4 months in county jail. There was no violation of probation in that instance, and this court deemed that to be a misdemeanor. When we look to Robinson, United States versus Robinson, there was also a suspended sentence. There was also 3 years probation, and there was 9 months in county jail. But the distinction in Robinson, in our case, as well as in Fier, is that in Robinson, the probation was revoked. During the probationary period, the defendant violated the terms of probation, and probation was revoked. Therein, the criminal courts could have elected to punish that person as a misdemeanor or under a felon or as a felon. And it was revoked.
Counsel, how do you distinguish our language in Robinson that talks about the judgment as being the critical factor to determine whether or not it was a misdemeanor or a felon?
The language judgment of conviction is contained in Robinson as well as, I believe, in United States v. Quell, but that language is nowhere contained in the statute in 17A, 17, and 17B.
So overrule Robinson because it's wrong?
I believe on the issue of whether or not, in order for a matter to be deemed a misdemeanor that requires quote-unquote judgment of conviction, I believe that is incorrect because the statute does not prescribe a judgment of conviction.
So is the answer to my question yes, you should overrule it, it's wrong?
Yes, Your Honor.
But let me understand your argument on the California Code 17. You're saying that under 17B1, a judgment is required, correct? That's one way to get a misdemeanor.
Exactly, that's not...
But you're saying that your client falls under B3?
I believe in 17B1, when it says after judgment, that refers to when the criminal court judge elects the punishment. There's no reference to any judgment apart from imposing the probation, suspending the sentence is required.
But isn't the word judgment a term of art in the criminal law within the California system?
Yes, Your Honor. What a judgment refers to, any time an individual's interests are affected by a decision of a criminal court judge, that's just any time an individual can appeal from a decision of a criminal court judge, that is in fact a judgment. At the instance in which someone is given a probation and a suspended sentence and time and a punishment of county jail, that affects that person's interest, and upon that, that person can appeal from that decision. So in following the term of art, it is a judgment. Once the criminal court judge elected to impose this punishment, that is a judgment on which this defendant can appeal. And that's
now, if we were to disagree with you on that interpretation of a judgment, is it your position that your client qualifies under B3 also?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm having some trouble understanding that because it seems to me the last phrase, the court declares the offense to be a misdemeanor, doesn't make any sense unless you can also join it with the first phrase as to when a court grants probation. So maybe I'm misunderstanding your statutory argument. You could elaborate on that.
Yes, Your Honor. Under 17B3, 17B3 is bifurcated by the or in 17B3. The first.
Okay, that's what I thought you meant. So let me ask you this question.
Yes.
How would, if it's bifurcated, how would the first phrase make any sense? Because it would read, when the court grants probation to a defendant without imposition of sentence, and at the time of granting probation, period. That would be the first sentence?
Sure.
But that makes no sense because it says, and at the time of granting probation, what? I mean, it leaves you dangling because it it then hooks up with the last part of the sentence.
I believe if we look at the statute in its entirety, if we look at the entirety of 17, including 17A and B, it makes sense in that when the court grants probation to the defendant without the imposition of sentence and at the time of granting probation, then we go back to 17B. It says that an individual is deemed guilty of a misdemeanor under the following circumstances, and then it goes on to list those circumstances. And one of those circumstances is when the court grants probation to the defendant without imposition of sentence. So that is one of the criteria upon which the matter would be deemed a misdemeanor.
You would agree, though, that in that case no judgment is entered.
Once the criminal court imposes probation and also imposes any punishment, that in fact is a judgment. In Robinson, it refers to a judgment of conviction.
If that's true, counsel, then doesn't that make number one superfluous? We don't need either number one or number three. If number three, when the court grants probation, that is also a judgment.
I believe it's slightly unclear, but I believe the language of 17b1 and the initial phrase in 17b3 have the same result.
So what does the phrase "and at the time of granting probation" relate to in b3?
We go back to the beginning of 17B, it states in pertinent parts that such offense is a misdemeanor for all purposes. Then we go to three, when the court grants probation to defendant without imposition of sentence at the time of granting probation.
No, but it doesn't say at the time. It says and at the time of granting probation, comma, and then it goes on to the ors. What I'm having trouble with
language
is you leave a dangling phrase there, so that phrase either has to attach to when the court grants probation or it has to attach to the ors. And so which is it from a sentence structure point of view?
The statute 17b3 is slightly unclear as to whether or not the and attaches to the language after the or. I think the logical reading of 17b3 would be that the first phrase before the or is one of the circumstances upon which a matter would be deemed a misdemeanor, and then after the or, that's another. Upon a declaration of a defendant, it becomes a misdemeanor.
Well, the fact that it's a misdemeanor, does that follow from that the offense is not one involving moral turpitude?
That's a distinct argument in that whether or not the offense involves moral turpitude is not based on whether or not it's a felony or misdemeanor. Whether or not the offense involves moral turpitude is whether or not it is an offense which involves a depravity, typical language of moral turpitude, fraud, or some sort of malicious intent sufficient to constitute a crime involving moral turpitude.
I'm saying it's categorically not a crime of moral turpitude
in that, for example, an individual can be convicted of a crime assault with a deadly weapon, whereupon he unlawfully touches another individual with a deadly weapon, such as a fist, such as a bat, or such as any instrument that court considers a deadly weapon. What's critical is that there is no requirement that in that unlawful touching that it involves.
It doesn't have to be a touching to be an assault. No.
But that
it only has to be a threat.
That's the intent element as to whether or not it requires some sort of depravity or requires an intent that's sufficient for a crime involving moral turpitude. That's not categorically so in these types of crimes. There's a broad range of conduct which a person can be convicted of a crime.
So you're saying if, instead of, I think Briscoe was the guy that she shot a couple of times. You're saying if she hadn't shot him, if what she'd done is hold the gun up against him and say, you cut that out, that would be a crime of moral turpitude. But being a few feet away from her and shooting him a couple of times, that's not a crime of moral turpitude.
Well, not looking at the facts specifically, underlying facts specifically of this case, the immigration courts are required just to look at the conviction documents and to look at whether or not the government, whether or not the Department of Homeland Security has submitted sufficient evidence, clear and unequivocal evidence that it was a crime not involving moral turpitude. And just by presenting the conviction.
I'm not sure of that because of the or in Section 8 U.S.C. 1182 A2A. It looks like the acts are an alternative to the judgment.
Your Honor, apart from whether or not this matter involves a crime of moral turpitude, if in fact the defendant was, the appellant was convicted of a misdemeanor, that would have been eligible for the petty crime offense exception. And I believe that is the gravamen of the issue here, is whether or not the immigration court allowed the respondent at that instance to see whether or not this was a crime involving moral turpitude, whether the government had its burden. Moreover, the government had, even if it was deemed that this was a crime involving moral turpitude, because this was a misdemeanor, Mrs. Membreno was eligible for the petty crime offense exception, which was not provided for her in that instance because this was a misdemeanor. Moreover, the cases in which define what is a misdemeanor and what is a felony in relation to 17B, they're distinguishable. Robinson, the United States versus Robinson is distinguishable from the facts in our situation because...
Distinguishable, or do we have to overrule it? I thought you were arguing earlier in response to my question that it stands in the way, and the way to resolve it is for us to simply declare it overruled.
Factually, Robinson is distinguishable from circumstances, and the Robinson is incorrect as well on both points. It's distinguishable in that Robinson, although the punishment was similar, during the probationary period, the punishment was revoked, and the court reinstated another punishment, which isn't clear from the record whether or not that subsequent punishment was a misdemeanor punishment or a felony punishment. As far as Robinson being incorrect, in that Robinson is requiring a judgment of conviction, that's inconsistent with the statute, because in the statute, there's no requirement of a judgment of conviction. In fact, if there was a requirement of a judgment of conviction, what we would have is we would have individuals similar to the appellant in this situation. We would have individuals who would never stand formally convicted, because once the probation is granted, once the punishment in county jail is granted, and also once the suspended sentence is granted, if there's no subsequent act in the criminal court, this person would stand in limbo. This wouldn't be convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor.
When I did criminal defense, that was the idea of an SIS, a suspended imposition of sentence. You never get to the last shoot or drop that enables a judgment to be rendered. So if the defendant behaves himself during the probation, no conviction.
That creates an issue in immigration court, because in order to find someone removable for the conviction of a crime, the definition of a crime in part is that an individual is responsible for the conduct that's outlined in the statute. But in order for it to be a crime, in California, there are only three types of crimes. A crime is a matter that is an infraction, a misdemeanor, or a felony. If it meets none of those definitions, then it's not technically a crime. And then these offenses where someone is given imposition of sentence, a suspended sentence and probation, if there's never any final adjudication of this matter, then the immigration court wouldn't be able to sustain removability, because the immigration courts wouldn't be able to point to whether or not this individual was convicted of a crime wherein it was either an infraction, a misdemeanor, or a felony. They would be in this limbo.
What was the status of the conviction at the time of the deportation?
At the time of the removal order, Mrs. Moreno was completed her probationary period, and there was never she never went back to criminal court and had it declared a misdemeanor. However, the punishment that was imposed by the criminal court meets the definition of a misdemeanor.
She had completed her probation.
Yes. So it's distinguishable from that circumstance in Robinson, whereupon that probation was revoked.
After she served her probation, was she precluded from going back and asking the Superior Court to declare it a misdemeanor?
She wasn't precluded from going back.
She could have gone back.
She could have gone back.
Could she go back today?
Yes, she could, and actually that is occurring. She's going back to have it declared a misdemeanor, but that hasn't been adjudicated by the criminal courts.
Well, don't you just file an application?
Yes, yeah.
So how is it adjudicated?
Well, the courts haven't declared it to be a misdemeanor, but our position is that in that she was given this punishment.
Have they acted on it at all?
They haven't acted on it at all because it's a recent petition.
When did you file it?
I didn't file it. Another attorney filed it, but it was filed within the last month or two, I believe.
Would that moot this case?
Depending on the determination of this, if it's declared a misdemeanor, I believe that this important issue that's in this case is that for those that when the punishment, I think that's the key language. When the punishment.
Why wouldn't we just stop everything for your client's sake? And right. She gets it or she doesn't, and we don't need to resolve any huge legal issue.
Yes, yeah. If she gets it, that was the intent of the party, that she would go back and try to have this declared a misdemeanor so that.
But this would be a problem if we went ahead and issued a judgment saying that it was not, and then the court changed the state courts changed their mind about what the nature of the conviction was, wouldn't it?
Yes, and the issue would renew itself, and that now it would be deemed a misdemeanor.
Yeah, but you'd be in the position of coming back to this court and asking us, for example, to potentially to recall a mandate that it issued.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you this: aren't those isn't that relief where you've asked that it be declared a misdemeanor? Isn't that pretty routine? Why is it taking this long? Don't they just walk those things through?
I believe so.
Don't you know?
When you file a 17B motion and the criminal courts make a ruling on your 17B motion, it's just that in this instance that hasn't occurred.
Well, have you got a hearing date?
No, Your Honor.
Anybody call the clerk over there?
We would have a hearing date.
No, serious.
Yeah, I understand. If the criminal courts elected to declare it a misdemeanor, this issue will become moot.
Don't you think that's the kind of thing that might be helpful for the in-bank panel to know in advance that there's a pending motion to declare this a misdemeanor, which would moot the entire case?
Respectfully, yes, I do, Your Honor.
But you weren't the attorney that filed that petition.
No.
But you're interested in how it comes out?
I'm very interested in how it comes out. I still believe that there's another important issue here.
Well, I know there are lots of important issues in this country today. But if this case is moot, we're not going to decide them.
Well, that's okay too. You haven't talked to this other attorney about what's happening?
As far,
I spent a few years on the Superior Court in Los Angeles, and I always thought that if you gave them a sentence and it was of imprisonment and it was less than a year, it was a misdemeanor.
That's
what I always thought.
That's hard.
And then I also understand that you just fill out this form. And you file with a court, and it sort of goes through routinely. But I don't know. I've been away from there for a long, long, long time. The before you were born, but so they may have changed that. But
was anybody representing Ms. Medrano in the deportation, in the removal proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor. That was another attorney by the name of Robert Burke. I began to assist Ms. Medrano on the motion to reopen and in the subsequent appeals to this court, arguing the issue of whether or not this was, in fact, a misdemeanor or a felony.
Well, can't you give us the file number and we'll have somebody call and find out where it is? It shouldn't be that hard. I mean, you can do the phone right here, you know. Do
that. I could do that, yeah.
Well, maybe you should.
Maybe.
Okay. Are there any further questions?
No.
All right. You have 30 seconds left to come back at us after the government, and we may have a little colloquy.
Good afternoon. I'm John Andre for the respondent. I'm hoping that I can resolve the mootness question and also simplify the discussion at the same time. In order for the court to determine whether or not Ms. Medrano qualifies for the petty offense exception, all that is necessary is to determine what is the maximum possible sentence that she could have received for her violation of California Penal Code Section 245A2. The maximum possible sentence that she could receive is 4 years in state prison. And to reiterate that point, I'd like to refer the court.
You mean, you're saying that if the court had declared this a misdemeanor, that would not have made any difference because she could have received a 4-year sentence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where are you getting this?
This is the government's position that we explained in the opening brief, page 10 and 11, and we also took this position before the panel on page 12.
What case authority are you relying upon to support your position?
No case authority in the Ninth Circuit at this point. We're just relying on the pure language of the statute.
Any case authority anywhere?
Not on this particular issue, but the clear language of the statute, the petty offense exception, makes no distinction between misdemeanors and felonies.
What about California cases? Are there any California cases on this?
No, because this is a question involving removability on the petty offense.
I understand. That's what I was asking.
Is this wobbler situation unique to California?
It's the wobbler. The wobbler situation is dealt with. The 78 is dealt with in the California state cases, but there's no. Clearly, no California cases on the definition of what meets the definition of a.
But the question was, is this unique to California, or does it arise in other states?
Well, other states have similar kind of statutes.
Arizona has a couple of wobbler statutes, I believe, and I'm not aware of any other states that promote.
So your position is that there is no such thing for your purposes as a wobbler. It's a statute that says it could be a felony or it could be a misdemeanor. Is a statute that would necessarily have a sentence in of several years.
Reinhart. And we base that on plain language in the statute, and in that regard, the government disagrees with the analysis in Garcia-Lopez. And Garcia-Lopez, in our view, is incorrect to the extent that it said that there was any significance whatsoever to the designation of the wobbler to be a misdemeanor when the defendant finished their probationary sentence. So our position, therefore, is that Garcia-Lopez was incorrectly decided.
Well, if you go back, just going back to the language of the statute, the critical language is the crime of which she was convicted. So you're saying that the categorization of crime as a felony or misdemeanor is irrelevant, and you simply look to the statutory
max.
Yes.
The statute, language of the statute is a petty offense exception. It says the maximum penalty possible for the crime of which the alien was convicted in parens or which the alien admits having committed or of which the acts that the alien admits having committed constituted the essential elements did not exceed imprisonment for more than 1 year and the alien was convicted of such, if the alien was convicted of such crime, was not sentenced to a term of imprisonment in excess of 6 months. We're not concerned here with the 6 month provision. We're only concerned with the 1 year.
We're just concerned with what's the meaning of the word crime in this statute.
That's true.
Counsel,
let's assume that this argument of yours fails and that we decide that there is such a thing as a wobbler for purposes of the immigration law and that this was converted to a misdemeanor by the state, that if it were converted, that then it would be qualified for an exception. Just assuming that there is such a thing as a wobbler, and that a wobbler could qualify for an exception. If that's true, and the court were now to declare it a wobbler and say it's now a misdemeanor, what would your position be?
Our position would be that it does not moot the case because the court is reviewing the removal order. Removal order was based on circumstances that existed at the time of the removal order. In order for her to come back, let's say that she goes back into state court, she gets a designation under 17B3 that it's a misdemeanor. She would have to reopen her immigration proceedings and get the board or the immigration judge to terminate proceedings based on her the nature of her crime having changed to a misdemeanor. Assuming that the 17B3 analysis applies here, and I would rather doubt from personal experience that DHS government would agree to a reopening of her immigration proceedings for that reason, and she is beyond the statutory time limits for reopening. So we don't believe that that would make any difference in this case. And it would not move the case.
Counsel, I'm having trouble following your analysis of 11882A2.
I just call it
2, the exception. My problem is that Robinson looks to me like a correct analysis of how the California procedure works. When you get a suspended imposition of sentence in California, there's no judgment of conviction. It seems like your argument works from the assumption that she has a judgment of conviction. Are you saying she has a judgment of conviction or not?
For our purposes, I'm not interpreting what the phrase judgment and conviction or judgment means with respect to California Penal Code Section 17B.
Let's decide what it means in respect to 1182. It says the maximum penalty possible for the crime of which the alien was convicted. Yes. Was she convicted? Robinson seems to say no. The way you determine whether somebody's been convicted of a crime in state court, I would think, would require you to look to whether the state court regarded them as having been convicted. Is there a way around that except for these alternatives about the alien admitting committing the crime or the alien admitting acts which constitute the crime?
Yes, there's an alternative, Your Honor. The alternative is the definition of conviction under the Immigration Nationality Act. That's Section 101A40A. That definition says that for purposes of this act, for purposes of this section, meaning the Immigration Nationality Act, a conviction occurs even if a judgment or some criminal offense, is expunged or later removed for some rehabilitative purpose or some other reason.
Does it define conviction, or does it just say that expungement doesn't wipe it out?
It does both.
Okay. Read me the language defining conviction again. I know it says for purposes of conviction, and expungement doesn't eliminate it.
If you'll excuse me just a minute. The term conviction means, with respect to an alien, a formal judgment of guilt of the alien entered by a court, or if adjudication of guilt has been withheld, where a judge or jury has found the alien guilty, or the alien has entered a plea of guilty or nolo contendere, or has admitted sufficient facts to warrant a finding of guilt, and the judge has ordered some form of punishment, penalty, or restraint on the alien's liberty to be imposed.
Okay, so what you get there is you use the federal definition, and it's a conviction for that purpose because the judge found the person guilty and imposed punishment, even though the judge didn't impose sentence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, once you get to imposing punishment without sentence, how do you keep from looking at the California Wobbler statute?
The imposition of a suspended sentence with probation and county jail as a condition of first 180 days in county jail as a condition of probation is a restraint of liberty, and it therefore meets the definition of this definition of a conviction. Now, to reiterate the point regarding what the maximum penalty Ms. Membrano's offense was, I'd like to refer the court to administrative record. This is the plea agreement. The page on page 155, the administrative record, beginning about the middle of the page, Ms. Fisher is the state prosecuting attorney. About halfway down on 155, Ms. Membrano, this is Ms. Fisher saying, Ms. Membrano, you will be pleading guilty to count one of the information. That's felony assault with a firearm, violation of Penal Code Section 245A2. The maximum possible penalty is 4 years in state prison. The agreement that has been reached in that is that you will also be placed on 5 years of formal probation. This was later reduced to 3 years. You will be sentenced to 180 days in the county jail as a condition of probation, and if you qualify, you will do the PAWS program, which is community service program. If you violate any of the terms or conditions of probation, including what I anticipate will be a stay-away order as to the victims, among other terms and conditions, you will be brought back into court, and you could be sentenced up to 4 years in state prison. Do you understand what I have just said to you? She responds, yes. Now, my point in raising that is just to make clear that there's no confusion here on her part as far as what maximum penalty she faced. There's no confusion that she faced 4 years in prison. Also, to add to that point, if the court were to go beyond the actual plea agreement, go beyond the actual conviction of the offense, and look to what she actually received, what sentence she received. She received a suspended sentence and 3 years probation conditioned on 180 days in county jail. Now, under this court's precedent in Ariana Torres, just receiving the 3 years probation in and of itself constitutes a maximum possible penalty of 3 years in state prison. And the reason for that is that probation, of course, can be revoked. And even if she gets probation, even if she doesn't go to jail right away, there is always that possibility hanging over her head.
Well, there was that possibility up to a certain point. When she completed the sentence, there no longer was that possibility.
That's correct.
So if we're talking about what was theoretically possible, it was at one time. But at the end of her sentence, it was not possible, and she did not receive any sentence.
The determination of what is possible obviously should and does occur at the time of conviction. And what happens afterward is irrelevant, at least with respect to the petty offense exception. It may be relevant in other contexts, in the state law context, or perhaps for expungement purposes, but it's irrelevant with respect to the petty offense exception. That exception makes no mention of whether something is felony, whether it's a misdemeanor, or whether it's a wobbler.
Now, how do you get moral turpitude out of all this?
Well, this court actually in Gonzales versus Barber held that.
We held once it was, once it wasn't. How do you determine whether a felony, say a felony, is a crime of moral turpitude? What felonies are not crimes of moral turpitude, in your view?
Your Honor, I don't think I could enumerate the felonies.
Can you give me a few?
Well, the crimes that involve a certain depravity or a deviation from standards of conduct, certain theft offenses are all crimes involving moral turpitude. And this,
well, give us one that isn't, would you?
A felony that is not a crime involving moral turpitude?
Yeah.
I know that there are some, but I can't think of any right now. I'd be happy to research.
Well, have you ever looked at Witkin on this?
No, I have not. No.
How about plain bad?
Alarcon on criminal law?
Not on this particular question, no.
Well, would you say it would be an act of baseness, vileness, or depravity? Would that be an act of moral turpitude?
It's a normative definition. It's a definition that has been developed by the board and also by the courts. And the courts and the board have agreed that crime, assault with a deadly weapon, is.
Well, the courts and board may, some courts may have agreed. Our court said yes once, no once. And that's what we're trying to decide. Now, obviously, it would seem that it's not every felony, or you just say, if you're guilty of a felony. Instead, you say, if you're guilty of a crime involving moral turpitude. Now, how are we supposed to determine which felonies are crimes involving moral turpitude? You say, well, if there's baseness, vileness, or depravity, which felonies involve baseness, vileness, and depravity, and which don't?
Again, Your Honor, it's that the determination is very specific with respect to different crimes, and I just...
Well, but I know we're supposed to make that determination. How do we make it?
You're supposed to help us write our opinion here.
I honestly, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, how about misdemeanors? Shoot, this one. Are misdemeanors, they can be crimes of moral turpitude?
That's correct. There are some that can be crimes of moral turpitude. Sexual abuse of a minor, for instance, could be a misdemeanor, a crime.
What'd you say?
Sexual abuse of a minor could be a crime of moral, involving moral turpitude. Certain theft.
I can't hear you.
Sexual abuse of a minor could be a misdemeanor and a crime involving moral turpitude. Also, certain theft offenses.
Crimes
involving certain assault offenses could be. Misdemeanors and crimes involving moral turpitude, certain theft offenses could be.
Can I ask you a question, getting away a little bit from the undefined area of moral turpitude? Is it your position that the petitioner here raised the issue of whether 245A2 was a crime of moral turpitude in the BIA? Was that an exhaustive claim?
The issue here is I think that he did raise it in his initial appeal to the board. He raised the argument that counsel has referred to here with respect to whether or not it's a categorical a categorical crime involving moral turpitude. He raised it in his initial appeal. However, he did not seek review of that decision. What he did seek review of was the board's denial of his motion to reopen. His motion to reopen to the board did not raise this CIMT issue at all. All he raised in his motion to reopen was the question of whether it's a wobbler is a misdemeanor. So in that respect, we would take the position that the court, the issue really is not properly before the court as under Stone versus INS. He did not petition to review the board decision to address this issue.
Let me go back to the wobbler because I want to make sure I understand your position. Your position is that a person who is charged with a crime that could be a felony or a misdemeanor is given a sentence like this, which says that, in effect, if you're a good person and you don't violate your probation for 3 years, that you will be guilty only of a misdemeanor. And you can go and get a certificate that you've only had a misdemeanor. That person, from the moment that he is convicted and faces a possible sentence as a felon, is always regarded as a felon for purposes of immigration law, so that if he has been admitted, if he has come entered illegally, he will always be an aggravated felon, even though he's a good person and if he behaves himself and serves his probation well. Is that right?
I think you're referring to. Did you refer to an aggravated felon or to a crime involving?
I'm sorry. Yeah. I used the wrong terminology.
Whether or not they qualify
for the petty offense. He will never be able to qualify for the petty offense. No, even if he serves out his probation admirably, he's stuck because he could be faced with a punishment as a felon. Is that the position?
If in fact the maximum possible was more than 1 year, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Does that make sense? Is that good policy?
It's good policy in the sense that these are serious crimes. Ms. Membrano's crime is a serious crime. It's a crime that's punishable up to 4 years. So my personal opinion is it makes very good policy sense. In Congress, I think if Congress wanted to make an exception, you know.
Well, wouldn't we want to encourage people to serve their probation?
Oh, absolutely.
And not to. I mean, I just. I guess.
Well, one
I,
way.
I guess I see.
One way that both the government and the petitioner could have their way in this kind of a situation is if the crime was committed and the conviction occurred before they were placed in proceedings, and if they were given probation, they would be encouraged to. I take that back. That's only under a 17B analysis. No, I think that with respect to the question of whether or not they could ever apply, they could ever qualify for the petty offense exception, it would not matter whether they completed their probation. Yeah.
Going back to the crime and moral turpitude issue. Does it make any difference if this is just a general intent crime?
No, it doesn't. And the case law is fairly consistent on the crime involving moral turpitude does not have to be a specific intent. In fact, in the board's decision in In re Medina involving, which I believe we've cited in the brief, involving assault with a deadly weapon, it even includes recklessness as a potential element which would establish a crime involving moral turpitude. In this situation, assuming arguendo that Ms. Membrano did not have specific intent to injure somebody, that's just an assumption for argument purposes, even if she was considered to have acted recklessly under the board's precedent in Raymond Medina, she would be guilty of a crime involving.
So your position is that a reckless act can constitute a crime of moral turpitude and does, a reckless threat. A statute that prohibits reckless threats prohibits crimes of moral turpitude.
Can you ask the question one more time, sir?
Well, I'm saying if we posit a statute that makes it an offense to commit reckless threats, a physical assault, a threat done recklessly, that would constitute a crime of moral turpitude.
Well,
it would be a base, vile, whatever the...
Yeah. General other elements of crime involving moral turpitude are met. The baseness and vileness and
Of course, we don't know how we determine whether it's base or vile, except by deciding that is the kind of act that's so offensive.
Yeah.
And reckless threat would fall within that category, in your view, that it would be so base and vile that, unlike other felonies, it would constitute an act of moral turpitude.
I'm just on the issue of threats themselves. I don't want to overcommit myself because I'm not sure what the courts have held on whether or not a threat is a crime involving moral
turpitude.
I recall an area where the law is fairly well developed on this, in professional licensure. Many states have professional licensing statutes that exclude a person from a license or exclude a person unless special leave is granted if they've committed any felony or misdemeanor involving moral turpitude. And the way that the misdemeanor involving moral turpitude is usually interpreted, all the moral turpitude crimes, they either involve sex or they involve dishonesty. So shoplifting or indecent exposure, yes. Assault and battery, no. Now, I look at this statute, it's not quite like that. Some felonies obviously do not count, and some do. In order for the felony to count against the person, it has to be a crime involving moral turpitude or a controlled substance crime or multiple convictions or terrorism or a couple of others. That has to mean that there are a bunch of felonies that are not crimes of moral turpitude. And I'm wondering why we shouldn't just use the traditional sex or dishonesty categories. I can't understand what base and vile means except that they really disgust me. It seems like kind of a meaningless subjective standard.
Well, has its roots in common law and as many crimes do. It covers many crimes that obviously aren't in the category of sexuality and sexual offenses. And
give me a couple of for instances.
Well, the situation today in this case, the weapons offense. Again, as far as a category,
by myself yet again in agreement with my colleague Judge Reinhart. We said yes once, we said no once, and now we have to decide. I don't know if that's helpful.
As Judge Kleinfeld said, there are two types of crimes that constitute moral turpitude, and what we have said in the Ninth Circuit in the year 2005 was that they are basically two types: those involving fraud and those involving grave acts of baseness or depravity. And those are generally, as Judge Kleinfeld says, sort of sex offenses, moral offenses, things that shock the consciences, one of the cases says. But the other category, the dishonesty or fraud, the kind that prevent you from becoming a lawyer, like lying to a court or doing anything like that. But the second category, because this is not a dishonesty or fraud case, the second category, we have said, are those cases involving grave acts of baseness or depravity. And that's what we're trying to determine. Is a categorical offense that's a threat of violence, is that kind of grave act of baseness or depravity that we're talking about when you say moral turpitude, or is it more like sexual misconduct?
Well, Your Honor, again, I would just say that both Both are covered. It's not, there's not one specific definition of a crime involving moral turpitude. There are a number of them that have been developed in the case law, and I see that I'm not doing a very good job of addressing this issue, and I certainly would be, I would welcome the opportunity to brief it further if the court does.
We have a lot of briefs in this case.
Three or four rounds. A lot on this subject, and one of the reasons was because of the issue of the jurisdiction issue, and I quite frankly didn't believe that the issue would be a prominent in the case. And to that extent, I may be incorrect, and if so, I would welcome the opportunity to brief it further. Our position, however. We do not agree with the proposition that there actually is a direct conflict between Carr versus INS and Gonzalez versus Barber, because Carr versus INS was not specifically addressing the individual's removability on account of a crime involving moral turpitude. It was addressing whether or not they could potentially be eligible for a state law expungement, and it's possible.
But it said it wasn't a crime of moral turpitude. Didn't Carr say that it's not a crime of moral turpitude?
It did say that, however.
Judge Wallace said that.
Without any elaboration or extensive discussion. And I think it's also noteworthy that Carr versus INS did not make any mention of Gonzalez versus Barber.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Was
this guy. Was
there anything?
17.
We'll give you 30.
The government's position concerning whether or not all wobblers, those offenses that can be punished as a felony or a misdemeanor, all wobblers wouldn't qualify for the petty offense exception is contrary to the definition of the definition of felonies and definitions of misdemeanors. The fact that in a particular instance a criminal court looks to the underlying circumstances and deems whether or not this, in this particular case, this matter will be subject to a punishment that's a misdemeanor punishment or subject to a punishment that's a felony punishment, it is upon that determination that the petty offense exception attaches to. It attaches to what it, once the criminal courts deem that this is going to be treated as a misdemeanor or deems that this offense is going to be treated as a felony, then if it's treated as a misdemeanor, then that person would, of course, be eligible for the petty offense exception. Not following that logic creates an equal protection argument, because what we would have is that we would have individuals who would be responsible for the same conduct outside of the California jurisdiction, because we're talking about removal. We have individuals responsible for the same conduct. And in California, that misdemeanor conduct that falls under the purview of a wobbler, even if the courts determine that it's a misdemeanor conduct, and then someone, for example, in Kentucky who has the same conduct, simply because in California it's deemed a wobbler, one person would be eligible for the petty offense exception and the other person wouldn't be eligible.
We understand your argument. You've more than used your time. Thank you, counsel. The case just argued is submitted a decision, at least for now, and the court stands adjourned.